Are we talking about the one entity that may have many parameters, or are we talking about different entities, or do you have an idea?
We don't have enough information to even distinguish between those two. This could be a grand central station where multiple different phenomena intersect at some kind of point for some unknown reason, or else it could be a single phenomenon that's manifesting in many different ways, or else it could be some kind of a dimensional phenomenon where there's a, you know, to use a crude expression, there's some kind of a hole in the sky where things come through. And the reason I mention that is that the previous rancher who owned the property on many different occasions remarked about this large hole in the sky that used to open over the ranch, and he actually used a telescope to watch stuff coming from the other side all the way through. I mean, he saw these flying objects that were triangular shaped coming through this hole in the sky. He could actually see a different colored sky on the other side. So that's why I used the analogy of a kind of a dimensional.
Yeah, we've talked about portals over the years with UFO and paranormal shows. You might actually have one there, huh?
Well, it certainly, from the rancher's description, I never saw any of those personally, but there were certainly a lot of different phenomena that happened that were very difficult to explain, except for some kind of a dimensional effect. You know, there were so many animal disappearances too that were very difficult to explain. We had, for example, four prize bulls on the ranch at one stage. They were in this corral, and the rancher and his wife went down to the other end of the property. They were talking about how valuable these animals were. When they arrived back, they found the corral empty, and they said, "Oh my God, our livelihood is ruined." They searched around the corral for a while, and then one of the rancher walked over to this very small white trailer that was at the end of the corral, and lo and behold, all four animals, huge 2,200-pound bulls, were packed into this white trailer, and there's really no way they could have got in there because there was no exit. So what could have lifted four extremely aggressive 2,200-pound bulls and put them into this narrow confine? The rancher went over, and he was so startled that to see his animals in this narrow confined space that he banged on the sides of the thing, and it seemed like that banging actually triggered a release from some sort of a sleep. The animals appeared to be sort of sleepwalking. They were stunned, and they went crazy when they realized where they were. So they kicked the doors of this trailer down. So one of the things that we noticed when we arrived on the property was that the whole area was extremely strongly magnetized. All of the bars of the corral had a strong magnetic signature, and that faded over a 36-hour period. So whatever was involved in this, we think, might be associated with some kind of strong magnetic field.
Yeah, evidently there were UFOs floating around, not only with the family that you write about in the book, but the previous owners as well. There were three dogs that were killed in a gruesome fashion. Was that more or less like the cattle mutilations, or what?
Well, it was much more graphic, I think, because the rancher actually saw who the perpetrators were in that case.
Oh, who were they?
He saw a basketball-sized blue orb that was very, very common on the ranch. He saw it coming low in across the field when he was sitting outside his house one evening, and his three dogs were by his side. The blue orb kind of moved around the field, and the dogs got very excited by it. So these were extremely aggressive blue heelers that were very good cattle dogs. So the rancher set his dogs on this thing to see what would happen. And this object, every time the dogs lunged at it, just dodged out of the way effortlessly, so it was obviously under intelligent control. So it began to sort of dance in front of the dog's jaws and lead them down towards this copse of trees. And the rancher was watching this as it unfolded. So the blue orb led the three dogs into this copse. The next thing the rancher heard were these agonized yelps of the dogs in mortal agony. Then it was silent. And he was too scared to go down there to investigate immediately. So the next day he went down, and he saw three rings of burnt grass down there. And in the middle of those rings were these greasy, black, oily substances. Obviously, he put the two and two together and said that the blue orb had actually incinerated his three favorite dogs. And that was actually the turning point for the decision to move off the ranch for the family in general. That happened in mid-1996.
So they literally were burned alive, probably.
They yelped in mortal agony.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an extremely aggressive demonstration to animals, and there were several others, effects on animals too. But the killing of his dogs really had a big effect on the rancher.
Well, I can certainly understand that. I'm a dog man, too. But all of these things. Especially the cattle mutilations and the lack of blood, seems to me there must be something going on there akin to a vampire legend almost.
Well, even a vampire kind of, when they slit a vein or an artery, some blood just spills. When I looked down at that carcass, it was perfectly pink. And what really struck me was that it was a combination of extreme force that had been used to pull the ball and socket joints of the animal's hips and legs apart, and at the same time had laid the animal down carefully on the grass with all four legs, perfectly spread eagles. It was like a combination of extreme force and very, very delicate,
surgery, right.
Very chilling to see that. And at the same time, the idea that not a single drop of blood was found in or on that animal. It's very difficult to kill an animal. Even an 84-pound animal has between 2 and 3 liters of blood. That's a lot of blood. So not to have a single drop of blood on the animal was pretty astounding. And then the subsequent forensic analysis that yielded, evidence of sharp instruments. We went through many, many, many gaming exercises to see if humans could possibly have done this or who could have possibly done that. Maybe the animal was taken elsewhere, killed, all of the internal organs removed, all of the blood sucked away, brought back, and then put down on the grass in a 45-minute span. But what could have done that or who could have done that?
And it would be pretty hard to do that without anyone noticing.
Exactly, especially with two people just down the way.
And
so with that element of the undercurrent on the ranch was always that element of, I would say that was a hostile act. So there was that undercurrent of hostility that was running through a lot of the events on the ranch. On another occasion, we set up 6 independent surveillance cameras to watch a particular hotspot of activity, because we thought that if we had cameras running 7/24, that we could at least capture some of these phenomena on camera. And 3 of the cameras were absolutely ruthlessly destroyed one day. All of them lost power at the same time. The wiring was forcibly ripped out of the casings. The PVC tubing that anchored the wiring to the camera pole was ripped off. I mean, it was a very violent maneuver, and there was a camera elsewhere that was pointing directly at the pole where all the 3 damaged cameras were. So we ran back, got the tape, played it to see who the perpetrators were, and this was just in the evening, but there was enough daylight to see there was nobody there at all. We could actually, when we enhanced the videotape, we could see that the lights of the camera, we saw the lights of the camera going off. It coincided exactly with the timestamp shutting down, but at the same time, there was nothing, no evidence whatsoever about what or who had destroyed those cameras. So there was those kinds of, if you want to take a hint, that's a pretty good hint to stop using cameras on the property.
It seems to me that whatever this was did not like to be investigated as you said, the hunter became the hunted. Is that the reason everything has kind of ceased as far as the activity, you think?
I think the first year that Niz was on the property, I think there was a whole state of different incidents, and they're all described in the book. And they culminated in some spectacular stuff that happened in August of 1997. After that, things began to slow down. The cameras were destroyed in July of 1998, which is, you know, almost a year later. But, you know, I think at that stage, the activity, whatever it was, had begun to die down. Now, whether or not this quote-unquote phenomenon had begun to lose interest or whatever, but there was a period initially after Niz moved onto the property where every time we were on the property, there was something bizarre happening on the property. So it was a very intense time, and then gradually over time, it became less intense.
And you really don't have any kind of clue other than maybe it's a Grand Central Station of all kinds of entities, a gathering place.
The only evidence that we really picked up was there were close to 100 different incidents if you count what the rancher experienced and what Niz researchers experienced. None of those 100 incidents are particularly alike. There are some commonalities among those 100 incidents. For example, some of the stuff was happening in the infrared region of the spectrum as opposed to the visible region of the spectrum. Some of these were associated with magnetic field signatures. So there were definite patterns like that, but beyond, you know, this sort of phenomenology of the whole thing, we were not able to nail down exactly what was happening there.
But you'd also notice, Jerry, that there were a lot of things that would be characterized as like almost what we call poltergeist kind of activity that happened to the ranch family almost from the first day they were there. Things like the you know, the wife would go to town and get 3 weeks' worth of groceries. She comes back home, takes the bags in the kitchen, unloads all the groceries, puts them in the pantry, goes to the bathroom, comes back, all the groceries are back in the bags on the table. Or the rancher was out using a post hole digger. He stops working on the property for a second, wipes his brow, takes a drink of water, turns around, the post hole digger is gone. And they find it days later 75 feet up in a tree. Those kinds of activities happen all the time, and in some ways they're almost the most frightening and unsettling of all. They would hear disembodied voices speaking in strange languages above their head, seemingly mocking them. I mean, it terrified them. We categorize that as more closer to poltergeist than aliens or interdimensionals, but there it was, all mixed in one big bag.
Yeah, you know, that it's just an incredibly strange and scary story. I'm surprised the family stayed as long as they did.
Well, a lot of people ask us that question, why they stayed so long, and it's Column knows the man who we call Tom Gorman, knew him really well, and he was just a kind of a stubborn guy who wanted to get to the bottom of it. For a long time, I think he felt that he suspected that it was the government, the military, pulling some kind of a psychological exercise or some kind of trick or trying to take his property. And he wasn't going to let it happen without a fight. So he would go out each night and hide behind rocks and in gullies and try to basically sneak up on the phenomena, whatever it was, or to catch these, what he thought were military agents, catch them in the act. And then that's obviously not what happened.
Now, in the opening chapter of this book, there's an interesting paranormal experience, an encounter with a wolf. And this wolf wouldn't die.
That was really the Gorman family's introduction to what was to become a whole series of really bizarre incidents. They were just unloading their furniture. They had arrived that day. They had put a couple of their prized calves in the corral. They had arrived right that day. They were unloading furniture. They saw an animal in the distance that, even by any standards, was huge. And it was trotting in their direction. And the closer it got, the bigger it got, and they realized that it was a wolf heading in their direction. But it was not like your ordinary wolf. And remember, this was in Utah in 1994, So this was a long, long time before any wolves were introduced into Wyoming or any of the locations.
Mm-hmm.
The animal trotted all the way up to them, and it came up to this rancher is 6 feet tall. It came up to his chest. It was a huge wolf that was completely tame and very, very at ease in their presence. So it walked around them and then casually bounded over to the corral, grabbed a calf that was curious looking through the corral, grabbed its head and its jaws, and started to try to drag the calf through the corral. The rancher, of course, reacted immediately and got a large stick, baseball bat, and started hammering on the dog as hard as he could, to no avail whatsoever. So he grabbed his Colt 44 Magnum and pumped two bullets into the animal. That had no effect either.
Wow.
Well, began to let go, but it was still really hanging on. So he told the son to go into his house, grab a 30-06, and come out. This is a hunting rifle that would bring down an elk from 100 yards. So from point-blank range, he put one of these bullets into the wolf, and at that stage, the wolf began to back off, showing no signs of injury, didn't make any sounds, just looked, kind of gauging the situation, and then looked back at the calf to see if he was going to take another lunge at it. The rancher was getting really, really freaked out at this stage, so we put another hunting bullet into the animal, and this time the animal did flinch, but never actually whined or showed no other sign of injury, but backed off a little bit, so it was 30 feet away now, and then finally the rancher put a third 30-06 bullet into the animal, saw a piece of flesh flying off. At that stage, the wolf just turned around and casually trotted away from them.
It made no noise of pain, huh?
The family was totally stunned. I mean, this, the combination of the five bullets would have brought down practically an elephant. And this wolf was unconcerned. It trotted away at sort of half speed. The rancher and his boy took off after it to see where it was going to go. And it disappeared into a thicket and then reemerged near a stream. They followed and broke out into that a level area near the stream and found that the tracks that the animal had left stopped suddenly in thick mud. And, they saw them occasionally in the distance. And then, a few weeks later, they vanished and never saw them again. But that was the opening strange encounter that this family, who were just barely moving onto the property, they were trying to get away from it all, the sort of small-town gossip, and they were getting away to a really pristine location when they encountered this really weird situation.
So it was not always the same wolf, but they were all big wolves?
Yeah, they were wolves maybe three or four times the size of normal wolves, and they didn't have any fear of humans. The nearest approximation is the an extinct wolf called the dire wolf, which went extinct about 15 million years ago. That was a huge animal, measuring sort of 300 pounds, and there's no obviously equivalent alive today. But the kinds of wolves that this animal family encountered were those kinds of dire wolves.
One other note on this wolf story, Jerry, is that when the family came back, the rancher came back and picked up the piece of flesh that had flown off the wolf after he had shot it the last time, the flesh appeared rotten, as if it had been laying out on the pasture in the sun for a couple of weeks.
Wow. Incredible. Well, we're going to wrap this up here in a minute. We could talk about this for hours. They need to pick up the book. They can get it at any bookstore. You fellows going to write another book?
That's a good question. The Hunt of the Skinwalker has only been out for two or three days, so we had a good response last night. We hope that people in your neck of the woods and your audience will give it a shot, because there's a lot more to tell about this story. If somebody wants to check it out, huntfortheskinwalker.com.
Yeah, which is interesting. We do have a link to that website as well. George, it's always a pleasure. And Dr. Keller, it's been great talking to you. I've heard a lot about you over the years. Finally get to speak to you.
Thanks, Jerry, for having us on. And maybe we'll come back and visit you and talk about some other things sometime.
Oh, well, we definitely will. if you're willing, we certainly are. We'll be back out in your part of the country in January and February, and we'll be looking you up.
Okay.
We got a lot of other things to talk about. Your TV series is, I like what KLIS TV's done with that Area 51 thing. Kind of put them all together, those stories.
Well, I think that's a great idea. I think I produced a two-hour show about Area 51 some 16 years ago and sort of put it on the map, but there's a lot of stuff that's happened in the interim.
Oh, I remember when you did that. I was out at working in Las Vegas and talk radio at the old KVEG, which is now KXNT.
That's right.
And, you know, you really brought some things to forefront, George, that no other mainstream journalist has done, and I really think you need a pat on the back for that. I mean, I know you've had your share of grief over it, probably.
Well, yeah, it's mostly the grief comes from my journalism colleagues. It just sort of drives them up the wall that I would take this stuff seriously, and they point to 1989 when I started doing the UFO stuff as the year I went crazy, when as I see it just as the opposite. I see it as I approach this material the same way I approach any other story, and the question is, why aren't more people taking a look at it? Because the kinds of questions that Colm and I are looking at in this book are the most important questions facing humanity, the most important questions for all of us in our lives.
And they are the things that legends have been made of, and they're happening today, and they do need to be investigated. Dr. Kellner, same with you. You know, you're a mainstream scientist. Glad to see you're interested in the subject.
Well, you know, my interest goes a long time back, and I think I agree with George. You know, there's two types of scientists. The way I would look at it is a normal scientist and a revolutionary scientist. And you know, there are topics that are obviously of great importance to look into, and I've always felt that science really needs to get involved in this area because it is inherent in the discovery process. It's a way, studying anomalies is really a shortcut to the discovery process. And out of the discovery process come new views of reality. So it is, I think it's really important for science to take up the baton. And I think that's one of the main reasons that this book was written.
How much bigger a question can there be than what is the nature of reality and what is our place in it? What is our place in the universe? Where do we come from? Are we alone? Those are big questions that I can't believe that other scientists and other journalists would not be interested in pursuing.
Well, a good point and good way to close the show. The name of the book is Hunt for the Skinwalker. You have a mainstream publisher with a good imprint for that, so you have good distribution so people can pick it up at their latest. They can order it at their bookstore if it's not there, and certainly go to your website. And that, what is, huntfortheskinwalker.com?
That's right.
Thanks a lot, both of you.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you very much.
Okay, it's been an interesting hour. Good night.
Good night.